Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last August, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough surveyed the political and social landscape of our country and decided the time had come to re-examine what it means to be an American. He put together a collection of 15 of his speeches that span 27 years of our nation's recent history in a new book entitled The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. Coming up, we want to hear from you about what you think it means to be an American. Give us a call at 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page, post your question or comment there. Joining us now is historian and author David McCullough. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be back.
I saw in an interview you said this book is in response to Donald Trump. You never mention his name, but, you know, President Trump didn't get there alone. What of that? Well, it's a larger scenario than just one man, right?
Well, of course it is. But I think that our 45th president has been voicing attitudes and behaving according to his own guidelines in a way that are contrary to most of what we've all been brought up on, both at home and in terms of the American character, the American creed and traditions. We believe in telling the truth. We believe in being kind to other people. We believe in our own ability to cope with difficult problems and, in many respects, come out the better for it with the problem solved. We also believe fervently in education, in learning, in use of the English language, proper use of it, even eloquent use of it. We believe in understanding the history of our country. We have a man now in the White House who's openly expressed disinterest in history, no interest in the biography of his predecessors in the office. He told a Washington Post reporter that he has never read a presidential biography, never read a book about the presidency, and doesn't need to because he has a mind that reaches beyond all that. Now that's verging on something quite weird and inappropriate, and particularly when you think that all of our very best presidents, the exceptional presidents we've had, and we've had a great many of them, have all been students of history, avid students of history. And said so. Some of them wrote history quite well. Dwight D. Eisenhower wrote one of the best books ever written about the Second World War, Crusade in Europe, and he wrote every word himself. Theodore Roosevelt wrote a history of the Naval War of 1812, which he began when he was still in Harvard. John Kennedy wrote his Profiles in Courage. It's a pattern that's been repeated. Woodrow Wilson was a professor of history. History is about cause and effect. It's about human beings, the human story. It's not just about memorizing dates and statistics and quotations. And once that's understood, then history becomes one of the most important of all aspects of the process of education. And I think we're not doing a very good job of teaching our children history and grandchildren history. And that's something that needs to be corrected. And a lot of Americans are very concerned about it.
My guest is David McCullough, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His latest book is a collection of talks that he has given over the course of the last 27 years. It's entitled The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. Listeners, if you're interested in sharing your ideas about the American spirit, what it means to you, give us a call, 614-292-8513. There's so much news today. Roger Ailes has died. The former head of Fox News resigned last summer amid allegations of sexual harassment. He worked for years to build the distinctive conservative brand of Fox. And he would say that he was motivated to make America a better place, that he was expressing his American spirit.
Well, if he felt that way, that's his right to say so. Mm-hmm. I think that we also have to judge people by their behavior, not just by what they say. And I don't want to get into an analysis of Mr. Ailes' career or his private life, But to come back to this, I think, serious issue of the denigration of American values, and to remind people how much we have accomplished by working together, not by smearing somebody who is our opponent or denigrating someone because they're in competition with us, and particularly our people in public life. Nothing of consequence, or very little, if ever, has been accomplished alone. It's a joint effort. This country is a joint effort, including, let us stress, immigrants. We are a nation of immigrants, and so to degrade, to cast suspicion on all immigrants is not only unfair, it's absolutely out of character with our whole tradition. And if you don't know that, if you don't understand that because you've never had any interest in it, then that's not to be a fully participating good citizen. We have been through hard times again and again. Yes, we are living in very precarious times at the moment, and we have some extremely serious problems, but that's always been true. And anyone who doesn't understand that is someone who's naive, someone who's unprepared to face the reality of the human experience. There's always going to be change, always going to be trouble, and there always has been. And history is a great antidote to the hubris of the present, that we think we're so nifty, so dandy, and everything that we do is surpasses anything that's happened before. Not at all true. Nor are we in more trouble than we've been before. And we've been in deep trouble again and again, from the time of the Revolution to the Civil War to the great epidemic of disease in 1918-19 and the Depression and the Second World War. My goodness, we have plenty of people around who lived through the Second World War and who know what trouble has been. Every time I see John McCain say something about the realities of the present administration, I listen up because I know what that man's been through. And we have to have respect for the past. We have to have gratitude for all that those who went before us did in order to have, for that we can have a better life, that we are the beneficiaries.
You know, you talked a lot about that in the 1998 speech at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania, to not look down on those from the past for not benefiting from what we know now, that we should not feel superior. And I wanted to ask you about something that's happening right now. Lots of people down south are struggling with the notion that who are in opposition to the removal of several statues in New Orleans that memorialized the Confederacy. How do we give that period of Southern history its due and also distance ourselves from that evil history of human enslavement?
Well, I think that we have to do it by understanding it and understanding that people back then were not always in tune with our moral or our ethical standards. And to take away the evidence of their former point of view, it doesn't take away that point of view from the past. It smacks somewhat of what the Russians did with their history. They just sort of tried to erase it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very skeptical about tearing down statues and changing the names of this or that. Are we going to change the name of Washington, our capital, because Washington owned slaves?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to tear down the Washington Monument? Where do you stop?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I would like to suggest is that we start giving credit to those people who have not had credit. For example, the only two presidents among the founders who never owned a slave, as a matter of principle, was John Adams. Why don't we name something in Washington for John Adams? There's nothing named for him.
I know, and that's surprising.
Nothing in his honor.
Yeah.
Why don't we step in and do some positive rather than negative changing? I I went to Yale University. They've just changed the name of Calhoun College because Calhoun owned slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe they could have named it for John Adams, because after all, John Adams had an honorary degree from Yale, and John Adams, to his everlasting credit, never owned a slave. And the next president never to own a slave was his son, John Quincy.
Right.
And both of those men had come under the strong, powerful influence of Abigail Adams, who was even more adamantly opposed to slavery. And yet, there's nothing to her on that regard.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think obviously the Adams haven't been ignored in history, even beyond what you've done in terms of writing about Jane Addams in that great book. But why do you think that is?
I don't know. And one of the reasons I wanted to write that biography is I thought, here's a man who deserves the limelight. Here's a man who deserves to be brought front and center stage for the first time. In part, it's because he only served one term. Mm. One-term presidents very seldom get much attention from history. And he was short, and he wasn't very handsome. And he had his opinions, and he expressed them openly and admirably. I think he's one of the most interesting and admirable Americans of all time, as well as one of the most brilliant.
Yeah, when I was rereading one of your speeches in The American Spirit, I finished it and I, finished the book and everything. But then I got out my John Adams book and started rereading that last night. The news.
Well, thank you. I love to hear that.
Yeah.
I had the most wonderful a time in my writing life doing that book. When you're writing a biography of length and substance, you're with that person every day, not for a short while, but year after year after year. And you get to know them in many ways better than you know people in real life.
Uh-huh.
Because for one thing, in real life, you don't get to read other people's mail.
Right.
And the letters and diaries that they kept in those days are as revealing as anything can be. And nobody in public life today would dare keep a diary because it can be subpoenaed and used against you in court. And very few people write letters anymore.
You, in the inside of the cover of your book, there is a letter from John Adams addressed to my dearest friend, of course, his wife, Abigail. And on the other side, in the back of the book, on the inside, is a photograph of the nation's capital of Congress. What's the significance of both of those?
Oh, thank you very much for asking that. The letter was written by John Adams his first night in the White House, and he was the first president to live in the White House. And his wife was still in Massachusetts, and she would join him very shortly. But he wrote to her, and in the letter there's a line that Franklin Roosevelt had carved into the wooden part of the mantelpiece in the White House. Later on, when the White House was rebuilt, Harry Truman made sure that it remained there. And then when Kennedy became president, he, or Mrs. Kennedy, decided that it would be better if that line were carved into the marble part of the mantelpiece to remain. It says, "May none but honest and wise men ever rule under this roof." Now think of that in today's situation. May none but honest and wise men. And what I think we ought to give attention to, particularly, is that he puts honesty first.
Hmm.
And that's to be remembered. Now, the back cover is a magnificent photograph, evening photograph of the Capitol Dome.
Right.
Which is the center of our government, the center of who we are. We are a representative republic, democracy. And I've been invited twice to speak in the Capitol and about Congress, about our representative government. And those two speeches are both included in the book. The first I gave, when I was asked to address a joint session of Congress, was in 1989. The most recent was in 2016. And so I think that inevitably it all comes back to Capitol Hill, our Acropolis. Yes, the presidency is of the utmost importance. There's no other more responsible position in the world than that today, and hopefully responsible position. But the Congress is where things ultimately are decided. And the devoted and, in some cases, brilliant members of Congress down the years should be remembered, should have attention no less than our presidents. But it hasn't always been that way and should be that way. Been some very brave people who stood up and expressed themselves. One of my favorites is the congresswoman from Maine, Margaret Chase Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And she stood up to confront Joe McCarthy, who was a rabid right winger spouting almost fascist philosophies. And she stood up, as nobody had. And she said, "I speak as a Republican. I speak as a woman. I speak as a United States senator. I speak as an American. I don't want to see the Republican Party ride to political victory on the four horsemen of calumny, fear, ignorance, bigotry, and smear." Those words are as powerful today as they were when she first showed such courage on the floor of the Senate. And that's why history is so valuable, because we can be reminded of good people doing brave things and accomplishing worthy objectives.
Why hasn't the study of history retained its place in our educational system? You made the point in one of your speeches that lots of colleges and universities don't require history for graduation. I was lucky enough to just minor in it, but a lot of people will choose not to do it. What do we know about brought us to this point where the study of history is not revered in this way?
I think there's a multitude of answers to that, but let me say right first of all, I think there are many subjects that should be required in our college curriculum in order to graduate, and history is certainly one of them. And one of the reasons I believe in required courses is I think it's also of great value to convey to young people that in life, some things are required. And it can't always be as you want it, what makes you comfortable, what makes you feel good about yourself and some of these other philosophical points of view that we hear espouse. The answer is probably that parents, understandably, are very concerned about their children coming out of college and getting a good job, a well-paying job. And that, therefore, you know, this day and age, science and technology and mathematics and the whole realm of electronics, communication, that's all the present reality, and that's where they're children ought to be educated so that they're guaranteed good salaries when they finish the whole process of higher education, particularly with the whole process of higher education costing so much. I think that's a mistake. I think that if a young person can come out of college knowing two things, mm-hmm. how to use the English language, both on paper and on their feet, and knowing history, they will be far better off heading down the road of whatever their vocation might be. Because for one thing, they will be very rare items. Young people today not only don't know history, many of them, not all, but they don't know how to use the English language. Something like half of the law schools now require their incoming freshmen, who are all graduates of college, to take a basic writing course because they don't know how to write a presentable, acceptable letter or report or any of that sort of thing. And that's a huge deficiency. And where education is not fulfilling its obligation. I just last year, probably the year before, published a book about the Wright brothers.
Right.
As you in Ohio know lots about.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it interesting that the two who cracked one of the most important, the most seemingly impossible technological problems of all time, flight, powered flight, never had any technical training beyond the physics course they took in high school, and they didn't finish it because they didn't finish high school. So that their lack of that was filled by doing it, and they learned on the job, as it were. And they grew up in a home where their father required that they read all that they could and read above their level of understanding, and that they use the English language properly. I know from reading their letters and diaries, and that those of their sister, their marvelous sister, Catherine, that they use the English language superbly. It's humbling to read what they wrote, these two who never went to college, and realize that they could write rings around any of the college graduates, or most every college graduate today.
Hmm.
One thing that history teaches us is how remarkable so many of our predecessors were in what they could do and accomplish and achieve that didn't seem to be possible, not just because it hadn't been done before, but because of the limitations of their own background or their own education or their own advantage in being at the right place at the right time or whatever it takes.
In 1999, you told a Dartmouth audience about our presidents throughout history, and you concluded that sometimes we make too much of our presidents, but on the other hand, you said we can never know too much about them. What did you mean by that? Where's the sweet spot there?
Well, we make too much of them because so much of what happens does not depend on them, does not hang on their abilities or their inabilities or their capacity to persuade people. Often it does. When John Kennedy said, "We will go to the moon," we knew we were going to go to the moon, and we did. But there have been plenty of other, Millard Fillmore, and we can name lots of the presidents who really, you can skip right by them because how they influenced the country or what they themselves achieved is minimal. And it often depends on the time. If you think of the time in history as an ocean, sometimes the ocean is smooth, sometimes it's rough, sometimes it carries us off in ways we never could have imagined, and at other times, up steps someone of absolute importance and magnitude about whom we can never know enough. We can never know enough about George Washington or Abraham Lincoln. We can never know enough about the minds of some of these people. John Quincy Adams, though he was not a very important president, and he was another of those one-term presidents, mm-hmm, who don't get much rating, but he was maybe as brilliant as anyone who ever occupied the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And his ideas and his interest in possibilities, as time would prove, were of considerable influence.
His mother's letter to him wouldn't have been, whatever she said, I'm paraphrasing, wouldn't have been horrible if he'd turned out to be a blockhead.
Right.
Always
he's, I just said that to a graduating class to Emerson College last week. She said, with all the advantages you've had in education, and there was never a book that you wanted, we didn't provide,
uh-huh,
and all the people you've known. Well, wouldn't it be absurd if any of us turned out a blockhead, when we think of what we've been given, the opportunities that have been provided for us, the chance to meet great teachers, to be in classes in a great college or university, all of that, not to say our press, our freedom of our press, and the brilliance of our artists and musicians, and writers. I hope that it's come through in my book also, as I believe with all my heart that history isn't just about politics and the military.
Mm-hmm.
It's about everything. It's about music and art and science and medicine. I think 50 years from now, historians will be looking at our time and saying, wow, look what they did in medicine. And isn't it fascinating that they just took it for granted?
Yeah.
What's happened in my lifetime, maybe your lifetime? It's miraculous. And we just say, oh, yeah, there's another new medical thing. And needless to say, we are the beneficiaries.
David McCullough, thank you so much for joining us. I always appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your questions very, very much. Believe me.
David McCullough, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His latest book is titled The American Spirit, Who We Are and What We Stand For. Coming up, we want to hear from our listeners. Who do you think we are? What do you think we stand for? 614-292-8513. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the values and principles that make up the American identity and what it means to be an American. You just heard from two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning author David McCullough about what he thinks. A recent survey from the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, looked at these issues. The polling showed that more than 50% of Americans feel that political polarization is a threat to our way of life. And 71% who responded to that survey said that the United States is losing its national identity. Joining us now is founding CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and author of The End of White Christian America, Robert Jones. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us is principal research scientist and deputy director of the Associated Press National Opinion Research Center, Jennifer Benz. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
Your recent survey results are entitled The American Identity, Points of Pride, Conflicting Views, and a Distinct Culture. What were you trying to get at with this poll?
Yeah, so we've actually been doing a series of polling throughout the past year to try and really understand what people think about the American identity, what they think its status is, and what makes it up, as well as trying to sort of disentangle the factors that the public perceives as uniting and dividing the country right now.
What do we mean by, I guess, a national identity? I think Robert Jones, in something you wrote recently, you referred to someone who once called democracy like a religion. What do we mean by American identity, do you think?
Well, yeah, I quoted G.K. Chesterton, who
That's
was
right.
a British writer who visited the U.S. in the early 20th century. And what's interesting is that there were these people from Europe, I mean, de Tocqueville, Chesterton, who were coming to the U.S. in the late 19th century, early 20th century, because they were trying to figure out how we were making the American experiment work. You know, in Europe, to be German, to be fully German, you know, you had to kind of have a German ethnic background. And the same thing to be in Britain, it had to be, you know, Anglo-Saxon or those kinds of ethnic identities were so wrapped up with nationalism. But here in the U.S., you know, the model, at least the ideal, had never been exactly to have, you know, a kind of American ethnicity. There was no such thing. And he, you know, had this great phrase where he said he was trying to figure out how the U.S. had made a home out of vagabonds and a nation out of exiles. And he thought we had done it by having united not by blood and ethnicity, but by voluntary assent to a set of commonly held, mostly political and civic beliefs that were enshrined in the Constitution.
Right. There were these things like the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the amendments, that kind of a thing.
Right. Right.
What were some of the essential elements to the U.S. national identity that were cited in the survey, Jennifer Benz?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's exactly those aspects of our system that are the factors that people are most likely to sort of define as core elements of the national identity. So, you know, the number one cited aspect as important for the national identity was a fair judiciary and the rule of law. But individual rights and freedoms defined by the Constitution, ability of people to achieve the American dream, and our government institutions were also cited by more than 7 in 10 Americans as, you know, fundamental to the American identity. And then, you know, on the flip side of that, when people were asked to sort of think about the threats to the American identity, as you mentioned at the top of the segment, you know, political polarization, economic inequality, and our political leaders are the aspects cited by most people as threats to the American way of life.
Hmm. Well, I turn to a call right now to something that's kind of in the news. Howard in Worthington, you wanted to talk about Puerto Rico.
Yes, I did. I've had the opportunity to visit Puerto Rico five times, and that has motivated me to read a lot about the history of Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
Many Puerto Ricans do not feel that they are part of the American spirit because they have no democracy at the
federal
national level.
Yeah.
They can't vote for president, they can't vote for senators, and they only have one resident commissioner in the House of Representatives, and even he cannot vote. And I was wondering if any members of your panel that you've been talking to today have ever read a book by Dr. Bartholomew Sparrow, who's a professor of government at the University of Washington at Austin. He wrote a book called The Insular Cases in the Emergence of American Empire.
Okay, well, let's ask. I mean, I think that Robert Jones, that kind of goes to the issue of that participating in the civic, the civic machine of America, being able to participate.
Yeah, you know, I think that the sense of belonging, right, is certainly tied up with civic participation rates. And, you know, so the case of Puerto Rico is certainly a very particular one that is where these things are in really bold relief, where, you know, as you said, there's not the kind of representation. You know, I'm here in Washington, D.C. You know, the Washington, D.C. license plates have on them taxation without representation, because there's a similar kind of problem of not having direct voting rights at the federal level.
In the district, yeah, right.
Yeah, right. So that's certainly there. But, you know, underneath this, if I could turn it just a little bit, the thing I've been sort of preoccupied with, and the thing I think that this Associated Press NORC poll did such a great job with is, like, that's all true. And people think those are, like, the most important things. But what I have been kind of preoccupied with is this sense of cultural unraveling, right, underneath the civic participation stuff. And I think that's where our biggest battles and fights are occurring. Just to give you a couple numbers from that poll that really stuck out to me is when they asked about what kind of culture is important for American identity, 2/3 of Democrats compared to only 35% of Republicans said the mixing of cultures and values from around the world is extremely very important. And on the flip side, about 2/3 of Republicans compared with about half as many Democrats say a culture grounded in Christian religious beliefs are very important. Those are two, like, very different ways of thinking about, like, what holds us together.
Yeah, and I was kind of, Jennifer Benz, struck by that Americans, you know, the feeling of America comes through in the immigration, and they tend to support immigrants, but a larger percentage don't support the impact of refugees, and they make a big distinction there. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that that is one of the ways, you know, in the current political debates, that these ideas of the cultural aspect of American identity are playing out. And there is, you know, relatively little agreement in the poll about what the immigration experience should be. And, you know, 60% of Americans feel that the country should, you know, has an essential culture and value that immigrants should adopt when they get here. And, you know, 40% think it should be more of a mix of cultures and the melting pot concept. But that's not how they see it playing out. It's actually the flip side, where more Americans believe that immigrants are kind of retaining their cultures when they arrive here. And then they do go on to make this really stark distinction between legal immigration, illegal immigration, and refugees. So, you know, nearly half of Americans say illegal immigration is a threat to the American way of life, but that falls to 15% for legal immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
And two-thirds say that the benefits of legal immigrants outweigh the risks, but fewer than half say the same thing about refugees, though viewing refugees as more of a risk to America than a benefit.
Has it always been that? I mean, Robert Jones, has that always been the case? Refugees are distinct from other immigrants? I mean, I know it's a distinct group. But
yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, if you go back in the 70s and if you look at polling around Cambodian refugees,
yeah.
if you know, and I think that some of the most troubling, actually, you know, in retrospect, if you go into the 40s and 50s and
right.
you look at, or the 40s and you look at refugees from Nazi Germany,
right.
even there were not a lot of, you know, not a lot of open arms in American public opinion, even in a crisis like that. So I think we've always been a little bit reticent. What I think is new here is that refugees have been linked to Syria and Muslim-majority countries, and I think the fears of terrorism in our current moment are coloring those numbers as we have them today.
We will continue our conversation about what it means to be an American with Jennifer Benz, Principal Research Scientist and Deputy Director of the Associated Press Newark Center for Public Affairs Research. Also, Robert Jones, founding CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and author of the book The End of White Christian America. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the values and principles that make up the American identity and what it means to be an American this hour. Still with us is the founding CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and author of the book, The End of White Christian America, Robert P. Jones. Also with us is Principal Research Scientist and Deputy Director of the Associated Press National Opinion Research Center, Jennifer Benz. The center's recent study is entitled The American Identity, Points of Pride, Conflicting Views, and a Distinct Culture. I want to turn to a call from Richard right now in Columbus, who brings up what he thinks are keys to the American spirit. Hi, Richard.
Yes, how are you doing, Ann?
Fine, thanks.
Another great program again.
Thank you.
Okay, here's what I've come to the conclusion of through life's experiences and education and everything else,
uh-huh.
and observation. And there are four basic documents here in the United States that really nail it down for what we Americans are really like and should be this way, home and abroad. Number one, God's Word, the Bible, as it's written. The Federal Constitution of the United States of America, as it's written. International laws, as they're written. And the textbooks on capitalism, as they're written.
Okay.
And that pretty well explains what we're all about. And if anybody takes the time to buy the documents and the books and reads them or takes courses in them,
mm-hmm.
And then decides to live by that, I can guarantee you, you'd be one whale of America. Now, whether you're black, white, green, or whatever color you are.
All right, Richard. Thanks a lot. You know, Robert, your latest book, you wrote about the idea of a shared language. And I'm wondering how much the shared language includes a shared sense of history and a shared sense of maybe the documents that Richard brings up.
Right. And was the first document you brought up the Bible? Is
yes.
That right? Did I hear that correctly? Yeah.
As it was written.
Yeah, the Bible as it's written. And, you know, there's always questions of does he mean, you know, the Greek Bible, the Catholic Bible, the Protestant
right.
Bible, the Hebrew Bible, and there's lots of versions of the Bible. But I think the bigger point is this, that this goes exactly to the number we were talking about earlier is, you know, a culture grounded in Christian religious beliefs being very important to, and that's something that is being sort of coming into being a settled view in the Republican Party, but not one that's being accepted in the Democratic Party. And what I think, you know, where I'm a little worried about is that we are at this place where we have shifted in the country, and I wrote about this in my book, you know, The End of White Christian America. The reason I title it that way is that we have come across this great divide, this cultural tipping point where we went from the beginning of Barack Obama's presidency, the country was 54% white and Christian. That's white, non-Hispanic Christian of any kind. And by the end of Barack Obama's presidency in this last election, that number was down to 43%.
But the suggestion isn't that it's because of the presidency. That's just the way the demographics are moving.
Right. No, it just, but I think it's not lost, you know, that this great demographic shift. Now, there's no causation here at all, but the coincidence that our first African-American president was president while we were crossing this big divide of white Christians in the country being a majority, demographically speaking, and to being no longer the majority. I think that's what's created a lot of the cultural anxiety that we're seeing in the country and the debate over what it really means to be an American, right? You know, there's a direct conflict between saying, you know, the Bible is a primary document and then saying the Constitution is right behind it, especially when the Bill of Rights at the very beginning is about freedom of religion and doesn't say anything about the Bible being a founding document. In fact, it secures kind of freedom of religion for all people. But I think those commitments are being tested, right? We've been able to operate with an assumption that we no longer really can operate with. And I think that bringing that to the surface, we really are at a new moment in our country where some of those basic things that have been easy to finesse because we've had a majority culture that other people were expected to assimilate to, and now we're at a place where nobody really owns the table anymore, and we're having to come up with a new model.
Richard, thanks a lot for your call. Jennifer Benz, when in your survey, when you talk about the idea of a shared language, people are responding literally. They think English. Most people think English should be the language.
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, we asked about that specific aspect, the shared use of the English language, as one of the factors that might define a national identity, and it did rank fairly high. But, you know, I mean, certainly on the flip side, on the looking at aspects of religion and a culture grounded in Christian religious beliefs, you know, that was the factor that was most likely to be cited as not very important to the American identity. And, you know, interestingly, we've seen in other polling that when we ask people in sort of an open-ended way what unites the country and what divides it, an equal number cite religion in both cases as a uniting factor and a dividing factor. Mm. And, you know, and we also see that the youngest Americans, those who are growing up in the most diverse generation in our history, are the ones who are most likely to say that the American identity is slipping away.
And that is because, well, let's hear from Chris. Hi, Chris. You're in from Mansfield. You're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Yes. Good morning. I'm an immigrant. I got my citizenship last November, but I've lived in the United States for 38 years. I just want to comment on the use of the terms refugee and immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
For immigrants to the United States, just to get a green card is a long and convoluted process. You have to fill a lot of qualifications and check a lot of boxes. If you're a refugee, once you come to the United States and you're granted entry, you cease to be a refugee, really, because you're an immigrant and you've been granted permission to come here. And then you go through the process of getting your permanent residence.
Mm-hmm.
Not enough talk shows like yours raise that distinction and clarify things these days, and it just contributes to just all the muddy views.
I think the distinction is really important. Why is it important to you?
It's important because it's what spawns this knee-jerk reaction about immigrants generally. When I got my citizenship and I told some of my friends, they said, I suppose all the others were Mexicans. And what they're saying is...
I'm sorry, Chris?
Documented aliens.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, and that's the confusion. It's ridiculous.
It's all conflated now.
Yes.
And
shows like yours should take steps and make it clear that there are a lot of aspects to this.
Mm-hmm. What do you think makes an American, Chris?
An American?
Mm-hmm. What is it to be an American?
What is it to be an American is that you like the country, you like the people, and you like the idea of living in a country with a written constitution, rule of law, and an independent judiciary.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And
okay.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
You bet. Jennifer Benz, do you think people understand? How careful are you? I know we go to great lengths to distinguish, but, you know, they still get conflated. They still get used interchangeably, the refugee, immigrant kind of a thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we... On the polling that we did made, we focused a lot of our questions around legal immigration and made that clear in the questions. But, you know, as was noted earlier, you know, throughout history, the idea of refugees is often conflated in people's minds with, you know, where the refugees are coming from at that particular moment. And certainly while this poll was in the field, the rhetoric in Washington was largely around the Syrian refugee crisis.
What about American exceptionalism? It was talked about a lot during the 2016 campaign cycle, Jennifer Benz. What do people believe about whether we're the greatest country in the world or not?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, certainly people have concerns about the American identity, but, you know, they still think that it's better than the alternative. So in our poll, we found a third of Americans think that the country stands above all others in the world, and more than half say that we're one of the best. And certainly there is, you know, a good deal of shared pride in a lot of aspects in institutions in the country, particularly around our armed services and our achievements in science and technology and medicine. But, you know, here again, we see that sort of undercurrent of, you know, concern about the political system. Mm. And we see that only 4 in 10 say that they're very proud of the way our democracy is working. While again, you know, going back, we see that more than 7 in 10 sort of define our American identity based on these democratic institutions and documents and principles.
Jennifer Benz, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Benz, Principal Research Scientist and Deputy Director of the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. And Robert P. Jones, thanks to you as well. Appreciate your time again.
Thank you.
Robert P. Jones, founding CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute and author of the book The End of White Christian America. Thanks to the AllSides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Knott, AllSides interns Kelly Rudolph, Kyle McKinnon, and Aaron McKinkley, and Owen Doherty, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.